Second item in our agenda or program, the briefing by the AG on his 2019 to 2022 draft budget and strategic plan. But also to plead with members, maybe before you come in, that we won't deal with the third item in the agenda because we don't have a quorum. And which is the consideration of the audit committee submission on the external auditor's transformation plan. And maybe if we could try and see if we can meet either Tuesday or Wednesday during lunch and things like that when we have quorum. But it's our own internal matters as the committee. We have to agree on that first. But AG, can you take us through your briefing on the draft budget and strategic plan of 2019 to 2022.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, we were here a few weeks ago sharing with you the outcomes of the annual report, which outcomes, as you will recall, were largely based on the same vision, mission, and values as you see them on page 2 of the slide presentation. And when we shared with you our annual report and its outcomes and our performance on it, Chair, we highlighted in all of these four areas that we focus on what was of significance for us. So if one looks at this strategic plan, it is a strategic plan that is growing from what we have been delivering over the last 4 years since we put this four-phase strategy in place. There are emerging issues, as we have discussed just in the first item this morning. There are emerging issues that will also impact on our implementation going forward, which are coming from the proposed amendments to the Public Audit Act. But we are not changing direction. We're just enhancing our capacity to respond to the demands that will come, for example, with the implementation of the provisions of the Public Audit Act Amendment. So if one looks at the focus and the direction of this strategic plan and business plan and budget, it is largely enhancing the capacity of the office to be ahead in respect of its ability to deliver on the audits at the stipulated time frames. It proposes to enhance the interaction once more between ourselves as well as our stakeholders in relation to the audit work that we do. It is also a strategic plan, Chair, that focuses on building onto the areas that make us viable as an institution. And you'll recall many of those things are to do with our people, how we look after them, how we make sure that they perform their activities without fear or favor, as well as to look at the financial resources that we need to have at our disposal in order to implement the constitutional mandate of the office. So that is what this particular plan and budget hinges on. But of course, Chair, as you know, when we came up with the amendments to the Public Audit Act, we were aware that it will require additional resources, among others, over and above what we often bill our clients directly for. And those resources will come in order to beef up, to enhance our capacity to respond to those provisions of the amendments to the Public Audit Act. And we have put in our strategic plan a quantifiable amount as to what that particular appropriation that we might want to access amounts to. So we've quantified it at somewhere around 50 million in essence in order to facilitate the implementation of some of those things come the time when the strategic plan kicks into action on 1 April 2019. So no change in direction, as I say, if you look at page 3 in terms of our strategic goal. We still pursue initiatives to produce audits that are value-adding. And I must just spend a bit more time on this, Chair. You recall that over a number of years, members of parliament, including some committees, including SCOPA as well, have been asking us to ramp up our involvement with state-owned companies. So what you have in this goal where we are pushing for the value-adding auditing, we've developed some methods internally where we integrate our activities between different skill sets, people in information systems audit, people with an investigations background, as well as those that are trained in core auditing. But now we have a solid base of state-owned companies that we audit. We've taken back a few. We continue to integrate our staff in doing those. Among the audits that we are responsible for, as you know, we've now been fully involved with South African Airways, exclusively ourselves. We are doing the audit of South African Post Office. We've just taken back the audit of the Trans-Caledon Tunnel Authority, which is responsible for water infrastructure. We've taken over the audit of Denel. We are also doing the audit of the Development Bank of Southern Africa. And a couple of others, Chair, I think out of the 23 listed in Schedule 2, we probably are responsible for about 13 of them. So there's a significant capacity requirement and a need to continuously train our people in order for them to be alert to the requirements and the needs of auditing a financial services environment and other entities that operate in the economy, in addition to the departments and municipalities that we audit. So we do believe that we do have the strength in terms of the people that we have, but we also need to commit resources to expose them to certain areas of training so that they are able to deal with all of the risks that will be confronted by auditors that were traditionally pursuing departments and compliance, as it were. Also, Chair, in this presentation, we have highlighted in specific detail some of the commitments that we have made in respect of the value-add side of our audits. I'm now on page 5, the knowledge commitments, where we still speak about expressing an independent opinion. And, Chair, let me just say also here, as part of the things that we have built around our deliverables here, is that when we say an independent opinion, we stick to it, because the people who are best placed to express an opinion are the ones that are exposed to the explanations, the documentary evidence, and their own tools that they use to assess that evidence. So we never go into an audit team. It doesn't matter which municipality or department it is. We never go to them and say, thou shalt. So when you say it's an independent opinion, we must truly believe that it is. Even I, or the DAG, is not allowed to go tell a team that they must express a different opinion. Because it's all based on credible audit evidence that we must produce if we are to defend what we propose. So that's why sometimes we stick our ground here, because we test the application of these auditing standards when we assess how people respond to them through the audit process. So I think that is important, Chair, and I think it's going to be more important that we're going to have an audit environment now that comes with the consequences in the future. On page 8, as I said earlier on, in this day and age, a lot of the people who are in audit committees and who are exercising oversight over some of these entities, especially state-owned companies, they also are looking for some additional insights that we as auditors are able to extract in these environments. For example, the insights could be to do with the effectiveness of governance processes within a particular state-owned company. And that's why we spend a lot of time also making sure that we don't just come and tick the numbers, but we also understand the overall operational context in the environment. So those are some of the major initiatives which also require us to continuously train our people. The implementation of the amendments to the Public Audit Act, we've also started putting our people in the picture in the organization, so that this whole project of the amendments is not confined in the heads of few people. We've already had an organization-wide interaction in preparation for the implementation of the Public Audit Act. And we had a big session which we were hoping we were going to share with you at one meeting that did not happen. But we still hope that we will be able to give you insights as to the levels and the depth of involvement of our people in this. It was a session that had about 250 staff at senior level and above who came to deal with the implications of the Public Audit Act and what we need to gear up and prepare for as we journey forward towards implementation. We will still stay with the issue of the continuous improvement on the quality of our audits. And when we reported in our annual report, you saw that we were still sitting above the 80% mark in respect of those senior managers that were assessed in respect of the audits that they had delivered. So let me pass the last one, number 9, which is about the implementation of the PAA amendments. I've covered that. And then if I go to the next strategic goal, which is about the visibility for impact. Part of the stuff that we do here is to enable and influence the players that are charged with oversight. We will, for example, before we release our general report, go around to all the provinces and inform the Premier, together with the Premier and their executive, as well as the Speaker and their team, as to the issues that we have picked up in the audits of that province. We do that also with municipalities as to the municipal councils. So that's the level of engagement that we have, so that none of them are caught by surprise when we interact in the public domain about the outcomes of their audits. And that is what on page 11 is referred to as ongoing engagements with stakeholders to enable them to influence doing financial management the way the law prescribes. Key controls have also continued to be part of this journey. On a quarterly basis, we've already started this journey over the last 18 months, and I think we reported at our annual report session that we were 54% of the way there. So having started, we are now at least over half of the institutions. We've already implemented what we call the key control engagements. And these key control engagements, Chair, are about evaluating the status of accounting records of these entities prior to year-end so that they are in a better position to implement any corrective measures that they would want to, with a view to improving their financial management, so that they are not only interacted with at the tail end of the audit process. So those are some of the issues that promote this visibility for impact. We would prefer that those that are charged with oversight are the ones who insist that their CFOs and their accounting officers shall do certain things, provided we've given them sufficient information. And that is what this visibility for impact is about. We often set ourselves targets with regard to how far we have gone in addressing some of these issues that we are highlighting in this visibility program. Over and above that, Chair, those now that I've been mentioning are your constitutional stakeholders. But our work has attracted interest, Chair, in quite a number of other places, including church or non-governmental organizations and big businesses or associations of big businesses. The other day, I went to present at the Banking Association of South Africa because they are also alert to the systemic risks of governance in the public space. Many of them get impacted because of the businesses they do, and so on and so forth. So we always find that there's an attractive element in the work that we do by others, to the extent that when we look for support in certain instances where we want to expose our people to, let's say, the financial sector, because we are auditing in that sector, and there are people who have been running their own big institutions in that sector, we are able to get into some relationships where we can get exposure for our staff in order to enhance their skills, because it's not enough to just be a chartered accountant. There are certain industry-specific insights that we need people to be exposed to. So we do benefit from these engagements by that, because we recently had an interaction with one of the major financial institutions who have agreed to actually support us by getting our people exposed to those disciplines, because when we come back to audit the financial statements of the likes of DBSA, of the likes of TCTA and others, we would need that kind of technical knowledge over and above the accounting and auditing scheme. So these are helpful engagements, and of course others, chairs, you are aware everybody speaks about promoting good governance. Others are associations and church groups and many others, including universities, where we interface with students. The opportunity there again is that people who didn't know about us, who are still at the learning stage in their journey, begin to be aware that, in fact, the South African Public Audit Office is not just one of those where you just carry a green pen and tick until cows come home, but it's actually an environment where they also can be trained and be able to pursue possible careers in the public sector. So we go out into many of these places with a view not only to showcase what we do, but also to minimize the cost of having to do what we do, because when people already know about us and they are interested in what we do as possible trading accountants, so it means we don't have to advertise. So we don't spend money advertising, because we now access them directly and be able to provide them opportunities and training. And that is why our learner scheme currently is probably the biggest in the country. We have 1,000 odd training accountants at first, second, and third year level who are spread across all the 9 provinces at different phases of their professional development and all that. The viability side of the plan, which starts on page 15, and I'm now on page 16, is really to look at how diligent are we in utilizing our own resources as far as the finances are concerned. And you would have seen that in the last annual report, we recorded a positive net position as far as the surplus is concerned, and we've already had an interaction with the committee on that, but we feel that there are signs that we are able to finance our activities out of the billings that we are able to raise with our auditees. One of the things that has also confronted us because of the billing arrangement is that at times we struggle to collect the monies due to the office, but we also shared with you the support that we received from National Treasury in paying for those old debts. I think it was somewhere around 150 million one-off payments, which enabled us to also write off the remaining balance for some of those struggling municipalities. One of the key pillars, Chair, in addition to the pillar of independence of the audit office, is the ability to continue to improve the skills and professionalism of our staff. We want people who work at the Auditor General who, when somebody says something to them that suggests that this may be an attractive option for you in your own person, they should be alert to the fact that as professional chartered accountants, they've got the right to say, no, I don't want that because it will interfere with my independence. So that's why we promote the professionalization of our workforce, to introduce them to the ethical standards that operate within our environment, as well as how to exercise their judgment when they deal with audits in complex environments. So these are the ongoing efforts in the background that are not always visible, but we believe that these are crucial in making sure that if we have got the level of independence, then the other side of the equation that we must rely on is the fact that the people that are in the field inspecting the different environments that we audit should possess sufficient technical knowledge and ongoing training for them to be able to interpret and to conclude on all matters they come across in order to express an audit opinion on the audits that we do. And then the issue of the protection of our audit teams, because of the escalated threats and intimidation, is another area that we have already started working on, as you have heard in the report from the generals earlier on. However, Chair, we would like to underline the fact that much as it is something that we must do, but there's got to be the bigger picture issue about what a public institution like this one ought to have in place in order to carry out its mandate properly. Information technology, as well as the investment in that area, Chair, we are also spending a lot of time in this area because we don't want to be overtaken by events while, for example, you'll hear all sorts of innovations that are happening in the information technology area, which speaks to things like blockchain technology. And we study these things just to understand that we do not fall behind with the development of technology, because we might be asking for paper when the client no longer has paper. But then the question is, how do you audit this client in an electronic environment where they no longer have paper? So those are some of the things that we are looking at to see when the industry and the audit industry develops over the future, we do not want to find ourselves on the back foot. So we're spending a lot of time also trying to figure out as well as to align ourselves with the tools that are available in the audit environment. We've already started putting a huge effort in data analytics as well, so that if we come to an operating environment, for example, like SASA, for argument's sake, we should be able to use data analytics to actually interrogate the entire data rather than relying on the selection of 30 items for testing, because you might get more efficiencies and you are able to get more assurance from the entire population by using data analytics and technology to interrogate different elements of the data. So that's some of the areas that continue to help us in making sure that we are efficient in improving our budget efforts. Again, on page 18 and page 19 of the slide presentation is where we set certain of our targets in respect of the viability option. Chair, just to be, shall I say, more democratic, I'm going to pass on to the DAG now to deal with the last V of this 4V strategy, which is the vision and value-driven, and just to highlight some of the key areas that the committee ought to be aware of. Especially this will be the last strategic plan that you, as this committee, will be supervising, but also to also look at some of the financial matters as we painted them in the budget that comes along with the strategic plan. And I think the last part of this will also be to give you a sense of what that budget, what these numbers look like, and then afterwards we can then take it to a discussion. So I think the DAG has got 4 minutes to do those two parts.
Thank you, AG. Good morning, Chair and the Honourable Members. The 4V looks at vision and values, and it's really about to what extent as an organization we model the type of disciplines that we expect that other people will follow, whether it's really about following our own clean administration principles and making sure that we run an environment characterized by transparency, by accountability, and also by firm internal controls. And on the other side of the spectrum, it's really looking at areas of transformation in particular. We also include in this particular goal the element around ethical conduct. On transformation, our journey remains as we would have laid out when we spoke about the annual report, in that we shape our contribution to socioeconomic development using the BEE scorecard, and we track all of that and report. So our goal remains to retain our level 2 BEE contributor status and make sure that each of our people in the organization has their own contribution in mind through all the work that we do, whether it's about whom we employ, whom we develop, from whom we procure goods and services, and to what extent we contribute to the well-being of other South Africans in terms of the socioeconomic development path. Our contribution around the allocation of work to black-owned firms remains a key priority, and we measure it consistently using the internal disciplines that have been pretty well established. The clean administration goal is one of those that is a non-negotiable. We often say that the day we don't get a clean audit is the day that all South Africans look differently at the National Audit Service. So that's something we take seriously and we embrace consistently through the work that we do.
on the aspects around the type of reports from an accountability point of view that we issue, whether it's the strike plan and budget, as well as the integrated annual report. We take very seriously our role to, again, lead by example in demonstrating accountability, good governance, and transparency. On the ethical conduct, ethics is an area that needs constant work, particularly in our society where most people will look to the audit office to model the type of behaviors that we expect of others. Ethics enjoys a great deal of attention in the profession as well, and making sure that ethical behavior is something that people are acutely aware of and are considering in the decisions that they make on the audit front or whether in how we run the office is something that we keep a great deal of focus on. So in terms of the goals and the measures, they remain what they've been before, around the BE level status, the clean audit opinion, and this is now stipulated on page 23, as well as how we respond to the ethical breaches or the potential or alleged ethical breaches that are reported to us for further investigation through the complaints process that we've established in the office. I'd like to now move on to the budget, if I may. The funding model that has stood the office in good stead for many years remains in place in terms of making sure that we increase the tariffs that we pass on to the auditees in a manner that's consistent with salary increases. So that remains in place, and we use a markup factor against what we pay our people because they're the ones who do the work, so that we still end up with a surplus that allows us to fund our own CapEx investments, for example. The surplus target is between 1% and 4%, and for the financial year 17-18, we had 2.1% actual surplus, and we're budgeting for next year a 0.8%. So it's slightly below our normal range, and that's really associated with the pressure on two fronts. One is we expect the continued pressure around audit fees. So our clients, you know, we end up with unbilled hours because of the affordability for many of our auditees, and we try very hard to pass on some saving to auditees. The second source of pressure, which is quite important for the committee to note, is the estimated cost associated with implementing the amended Public Audit Act. We've budgeted 87 million rand in terms of additional costs associated with implementing the amendments to the Public Audit Act. It's really taking into account the training needs, the needs for additional hands and capacity so that we can do what's required. We've requested through appropriation from the National Treasury a figure of 50 million rand, and the balance between 87 and 50 million is what is putting pressure on our cash flows, because we anticipate that we would be able to still shoulder that in our own cash flows. So I think just so that the committee is aware, we know that the number is going to be 87 million rand. We undertake to fund the balance between 87 and 50, and have an expectation that we will indeed receive at least the 50 from the National Treasury. In terms of the other budget items, we've limited the growth in audit fees to a figure of 7%, which is in line with what we would anticipate our salary bill to increase by. Our overheads we've contained to a great deal in terms of managing cost savings, and it's a discipline that we've been establishing over the last 4 years, and it really has borne fruit. Members might recall that when we were here for the annual report, I did indicate that we'd made significant savings because of the big efforts we'd be making around cost savings. Some of them we knew are going to be once-off. But we'll continue on the journey of managing costs down. Our overhead number increases by 12%, but that's including the additional costs associated with the Public Audit Act. If we had not the need to provide for that, you would have seen an overhead increase of 5%, which is still just about in line with CPI. And I think that's really it in terms of highlighting the budget numbers. The last slide indicates the CAPEX investments that we expect to make over the course of the financial year. The big numbers are really about, you know, I think what is normal for the office, which is computer equipment, notebooks. There is a number for leasehold improvements of 57 million rand, which does look unusual. That is associated with costs provisions that we've made for the head office transition. We anticipate our lease at the head office is expiring at the end of next year, and 2019, and we anticipate that we would be moving premises. We've overgrown those premises, and we would need new premises, and we anticipate that we would have some cash outflow associated with the installation for new premises. We hope to still contain that cost beyond what we've budgeted for, depending on where we move and the negotiations with the identified landlord, but that's what we've provided for in the numbers. That's it in terms of the budget and value for. Thanks, AG.
All right, then the last bit of this chair is not in the slide presentation, but I'll just talk to it. When we submit the strategic plan every year, we are also required to once again submit the audit directive. And the audit directive is really an articulation of the parameters within which we audit, the things that we take into account when we plan and prepare for our audits, as well as the context and parameters within which we report. So that document will also be on its way to yourselves as a committee, so you can have an appreciation that we do not shift the goalposts every year when we perform our audits. And that's a document which is required by the Public Audit Act to be submitted with the strategic plan so that the committee can have a view independently as to whether we have lowered the bar or whether we have set the bar too high to a point where someone in the ordinary department may not be able to meet it. So that audit directive, I haven't seen it in the summary of the presentation, but it will come together with the strategy plan, the full document as part of that. So that when we have another, normally we would have an opportunity to get some insights from the committee in the new year. It's always been like that. We would meet now in November and then somewhere in January or so we'll get some feedback from the committee. So we would welcome any inputs once you've had a chance to look at that document as well, so that we can continuously take some inputs from you or have an opportunity to clarify certain areas in terms of what is in that audit directive. So, Chair, what we are presenting to you today in this summary form then is what our plans are for the year 2019 onwards and what are the key areas of focus and how are we going to translate our audit directive through all of the audits that we do. And that is effectively the essence of our presentation for you today, as well as to see where the bulk of the funds that we raise through audit fees are going to go. And so we will pick it up then after we've implemented this in the annual report for the subsequent year. So back to you, Chair. We've got nothing further to add unless there are specific questions we might need to answer. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the presentation. Honourable members, any points of clarity, discussions? Honourable member?
Thank you, Chair. I'm not sure whether this is the exact point to raise it, but it is essentially under the presentation of the Auditor General. My colleague that couldn't be here today, Alan McLachlan, he raised concerns with me that the surplus that the Auditor General has declared that we're being asked to let them keep it for the purposes that are set out in the documents, he expressed concerns that according to him, year on year, that's made up of debts owed to the AG, and that essentially that would reflect as an asset on a bank statement or when going to a bank, but that it's not necessarily actual money in the bank. So I'd just like to request clarity on that and to determine what that surplus is made out of. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. Just 3 points, AG. The funding model. Deputy, you indicated that you are keeping your fingers crossed that Treasury will give you 50 million, right? But you're not saying to me what is the fallback position if it doesn't happen. The second point is, I don't know if I understood you correctly, or heard you correctly. I thought I heard you saying that you're going to up the audit fee on average by about 7%. And that is mainly due to the fact that is probably the increase on employee costs, for want of a better word. Now, all over, the drive is to reduce employee costs. 5% is probably what they're looking at. Why are you looking at 7% for employee costs from your side? I know there's always a fight about MPs get 0%, but we always try and fight for 5%. Unions fight for 12% and end up with 5%. Why do you think that you should be doing 7%? I'm just talking about employee costs, but secondly, we know that many of these municipalities just don't have a tax base. Is it not going to exacerbate the bad debt situation? It's just a question around the 7% in your rationale. The second point that I'm not hearing, and maybe it's there somewhere. We spoke about it earlier on the rise in the contestation of audit findings. What is our plan? What are we doing about it? Are we just lamenting about it? Is there something that we're doing? Because AGU indicated that it's probably going to get worse before it gets better. And then the final point, throughout the first V, we were talking about improving the quality, improving skills and that type of thing. You know, with the unfortunate developments of VBS, where so much money from municipalities was taken from municipalities and misappropriated, for want of a better word. Did you guys pick it up? Did you guys learn any lessons from that? Because I would have imagined that at some point the AG or the auditors should have raised the flag. I'm not saying you didn't raise it. I'm just saying, did you? Or did we learn lessons from that? That you can have a situation where so blatantly the MFMA is, I don't know what is the word, it's just disregarded. Are there any lessons that we've learned from that so that we can make sure that not just at local level, but at any level, we are able to proactively stop that type of thing, lest we also become victims of the KPMGs and those others of this world? Because, I mean, we're the auditors. So what are the lessons that we've learned from VBS and those type of things? Thanks.
Thanks for the questions. I hope this is the right platform to raise this. I'm just thinking out loud. The rental of 57 million. And I'm thinking about other departments that are also renting. Is it not cheaper to have your own place for that 57 million? What is the problem? I mean, rental to me is not like it's going to be your asset at the end of the day. You are paying rental for so many years and you've been doing that for years. Is it a problem maybe it will also answer the questions that I have in mind of other departments that keeps on renting. What is the rationale behind the renting instead of buying your own property and then having it as an asset? And I agree with Comrade Vincent that if you had to write off debts from municipalities and you want to increase again the rate, is it not going to take you back to the same situation that you had before you wrote off debt? What if you don't get money again from Treasury? Because it's something that you can deal with. Thanks.
Chair, let me start with the one about the physical assets, their ownership versus renting. I'll use an example of a recent case. At the end of May, our Gauteng provincial office lease expired. That property is located in Houghton. We vacated the property at the end of May into an environment not far from where we were before. That property, as we speak to this day, is still to let. And sometimes that's the risk of owning some of these assets, because you never know what the demands in the market are going to be, and you might sit with this huge property that you own, which you probably no longer need for various reasons, either you've outgrown it and all of that. So I think there's more risks there, because also if you look at how most companies are moving and other institutions generally, they are moving into virtual environments where sometimes they just secure meeting rooms which are owned by property management companies, and all they want is just to meet because they will use technology for very other things and all of that. So I think that flexibility to know that you can walk out of a particular environment without worrying about the carrying costs of owning the property once you've left it is probably one of the advantages. Because then you have to invest in landlord type things that you probably did not have to, because now you've got to maintain this thing, you've got to keep it in a particular shape, spending more and more on it as well. So we've taken a view that for various reasons and from where we are across all the nine provinces, it will be much better from a flexibility point of view once we grow and once we have a need to move in a particular area. At least we know that all we pay is the cost of occupying that property rather than owning it. On the part of the VBS, Honorable Smith, if you look at the audits for the 2016-2017 year, that's when this trigger was starting. And at that time, it was confined among those municipalities in Limpopo. It then spread out into others, like Northwest, in the year that we are auditing now, the one that we're going to report on at the end of this month. As far as the balances that were transferred in the first year when these transactions, you'll know that many of them came towards around 2015-2016 period, those transfers into VBS. So in that year that we reported on last year, I think it is correct to say that short of just performing procedures for the validity of the balance in the bank account to what was in the accounting records, we did not stretch our procedures beyond that, because it was an instance that had crept in that year. And we followed up with our teams in Limpopo. They basically missed the part where they should have looked at why was there a change, or why was there a need to transfer money to another bank. That inquiry didn't happen, but at least now, because of the wide area of municipality that have invested, that procedure has been picked there. So I think when you look at the municipality audit outcomes for this year, you will see a lot of stuff that the auditors have done to determine appropriateness of that investment in terms of Section 7 of the MMMA. But it is correct to say in the year when it started, we didn't perform further procedures, and the guys just did the basic, but subsequently we have caught on to it. And one of those things is one of the things I think which you've raised, Honorable Smith, that when there's a change, that's what triggers the risk management in the audit. Because the fact that you are now suddenly showing the full cash, but some of it in the previous year it was sitting at Standard Bank, but now you've got 80% of it at Standard Bank and 20% of it at, let's say, VBS. And that's when the risk response needs to be triggered with an auditor. And that's what it did not happen in the first year because it was confined in those few municipalities, but subsequently we have caught on to that risk. The rise in contestations of audit findings, what are we doing about this? Chair, I think the issue of the contestations, no doubt in our minds that they will continue to be a feature of what we do. I recall there was a time when people in the audit, in the office, or maybe let's say 5-8 years ago, would come back with an audit conclusion without any level of contestation, as it were. And maybe because people then that were being audited knew that it only took just an explanation to give to the auditors and get them to go away, you know, with that explanation as a reason why there is, for example, irregular expenditure. Because the person knows that even if I have a disclaimer of an opinion, there was a time when those disclaimers were a huge portion of the conclusions in the audits. But it's because that if you didn't give us that document that we were looking for to substantiate the transaction, nobody was going to ask the question after the auditors have been spoken to. So there was not going to be any follow-up. But I think now the system, people have gotten sensitized to the fact that you actually have to answer to the fact that there are irregular expenditures under your watch. And I think that's where some of those contestations are coming from. And I don't think we can wish them away. But on our side, the question is, what are we going to do? We've already interacted with this issue, particularly the growing rate of litigation. Sometimes we never understand where some of the people who take us to court are coming from, because the stuff that they sometimes are complaining about finds expression through the audit process for the longest time. We interact with them and say, there is a standard that has been developed by the National Treasury, for example, on what is called the Modified Cash Standard. That standard was introduced by National Treasury because what was happening with the introduction of implementing agents who are third parties in some instances to the state would be engaged by departments or entities to perform tasks that were traditionally meant to be performed by those departments. So it's a third party, and all you do, you just show the transfer of money as transfers without any transparency as to where was this transfer going and what was it doing, what was it buying. Now the auditors are insisting on wanting to know, even from the point of view of the implementing agent, what that money was buying. And that's where the bulk of these contestations are, because you'll notice in certain cases it just becomes a channel to transfer the money to a third party, hoping that the AG does not have responsibilities to audit that third party. Now, a transfer is just a line item. Sometimes it can be 200 million that is shown as transfers. Does anybody know transfers for what? And that's the key issue that I think is coming in, because those are the areas that get manipulated in the system to hide the true nature of the transaction. And it normally, when you ask deeper and deeper and deeper questions, it then triggers these contestations. So there are two players in the system here who need to check up the act. Firstly, on the side of National Treasury, who is responsible for setting the accounting framework, they ought to insist with all these auditees that these are the rules of the game. Like Honorable Cody was saying earlier on, SARS collects the tax, National Treasury distributes and determines how it shall be accounted for between them and the people that we audit. We come at the tail end to come and give assurance as to whether those people have accounted for that money as prescribed by the accounting regulations set by National Treasury. And that's a requirement of Section 216, I think, which provides for the Treasury discipline in the Constitution. So it's not some law that has been developed by some imagination. It comes from the Constitution to say there shall be a National Treasury that will determine the norms and standards around which monies will be accounted for. We follow behind National Treasury and we say, this is what National Treasury rules say you must do. You didn't. And that's where we normally pick up the fight. But the fight sometimes is not meant to be our fight. It's meant to be the fight that must be championed by National Treasury, because they are the guardian of the national purse. The Constitution requires them to be, and we are required to attest to the adherence of that discipline. So the fight is taken with wrong people most of the time. We've seen that with the matter that was reported in the papers, that all of a sudden now the contestation is with us having been the ones who signed the audit report, but the 32-page document that articulates the technical position was not developed by us. We just developed an understanding of it. It was originated by National Treasury. So I think in the pursuit of trying to manage this thing as well, so that it doesn't become the major problem of the audit office, it would be helpful if the committee could also help in elevating the role that must be played, particularly by the Accountant General's office, in the mechanisms and the development and adherence to the norms and standards for accounting for financial management in government. Maybe there can be peace to the greatest extent as far as most of those things are concerned. The tax base of municipalities. Chair, when we considered some of the amendments as well as the financial regulations that will come in support of the amendments that we've made in respect to the 1% difference of net assets for municipalities, those municipalities with a limited tax base will be addressed in that context. So we will take into account the fact that this is a municipality that does not have an elaborate set of resources. It relies on an appropriation. And in consultation with National Treasury, we'll come to an arrangement which says this is the minimum level of assurance as auditors that you need to provide, because we do not really deploy huge amounts of money there, so you don't have to go the whole hog in terms of deploying your auditing intervention in that institution. So we are waiting to make sure that at least we can confine these ones. Because what we'll say, you will say, here is a museum that has got old strategic assets, but there are no real operational activities except for, as an example, except for the employment of 3 people who are custodians of these national assets in the museum. There's no major business activity that happens here. So National Treasury, what level of assurance do you need from that particular museum or from those hospital boards, if that's what we are supposed to audit, so that we don't bring huge effort in trying to mitigate a limited risk? And that's what we'll find expression after we have finalized the application of the audit methodology. And then on the, let me speak about the surplus. The surplus, because we are billing, we often carry the debit in our books as a debtor until it is paid. Because those people that we audit, we will bill them and raise the revenue, and then the debit will be sitting as a debtor until it is paid in the bank. So you are right. That surplus is not purely cash. It is a combination of debt, and some of it is possibly cash. We have not split it up, as it were, but the biggest portion of it will be amounts that have not been paid, which have already been recognized in the income statement as revenue. So when we say, can we retain this surplus, we are also by implication saying, can we retain this debt in most instances? And sometimes it never gets paid for years and years and years and years and years and remain a debt, but I agree that a portion of it is indeed cash. Because the risk is that the public debt says you must repatriate either you repatriate the surplus back to the National Revenue Fund, it will be easy for somebody who received an appropriation upfront, because the appropriation would have come as cash, there's no doubt about it. And if you didn't spend it, it means you already have the cash. But with us, we bill with the hope that we trust that you will pay us. And when you don't pay us, we might run the risk of having to repatriate the cash back to the National Revenue Fund, which we never received anyway. Then the 50 million, sorry? Yeah, the 50 million regarding the request, we know that it can possibly go either way, but in the realm of all of that we do in terms of the quantum, look at 50 million in relation to the, I think, 3.4 billion worth of revenue in terms of fee income that we raise. So we'll try and see if we can find other alternatives ready to deal with it. But it's a once off. It's not a recurring 50 million. It's just to beef up the stuff that we need to do in the year that we are going to be implementing the PAA. Hopefully there will be no other requirement of a similar quantum going forward. So we hope that at least because it's a once off, it will not rattle the National Revenue Fund insofar as the implications of giving us 50 versus what the real need, which is 87, is in this instance. So we're just hoping, Chair, we know that we cannot preempt what the outcome is going to be, but I hope that it won't cause too much slippage in terms of the things that we want to do with it. And then why are we not limiting our employment cost to 5%. We are in a race, Chair, here also of trying to retain and attract a very mobile group of people, both in terms of the technical competency they possess, as well as the attractiveness of chartered accountants and those similarly trained people in the outside environment. And so when we make the decisions in respect of how to raise the increases from an employment point of view, we also take into account the fact that there's sometimes a space where we need to pepper this with a little bit of sugar, in a way, you know, so that we don't make it too sweet, but at least it must not be something that people want to walk away from. Essence. So I think we take deliberate steps as part of our retention strategies, because what we are able to offer as a public audit institution is sometimes far behind, relatively speaking, to what others who might be targeting the people that we train are able to offer. And this gap, maybe this 2%, in a way, if you look at it, saves us from being out there trying to fill up the gaps that have opened as a consequence of people saying it's not worth sitting around here for this 4% type of stuff. So I think there's a way where we can say that, much as we do not really go out of the way in terms of the bounds of the salary increases as determined, and as compared to the industry as well as in the public sector, I think we are still within a range. But we try and do it such that we're not making it less attractive for people to want to stick around. Yeah, because the reality, Chair, is that if you think about a chartered accountant with 3 to 5 years experience, some other places in the same economy, they normally command double the thing. So all you need to do is to just come in and say, you know, what you are doing here in terms of the substance and the qualitative elements of the work that you do is potentially more beneficial than what you will put in your pocket as double the salary. So those are some of the issues that we normally have an engagement on. So I would say we're not out of line, even if it's not 5%. So that's a long way of saying we're not out of line at 7%, Chair. I don't know if there's any other question I didn't answer, but I think I have covered all of them.
Thank you very much for that, and as we have agreed earlier on, not agreed. We still have to talk to members if they're available during the week to make sure that we agree on a strategic plan. But the honourable members were supposed to meet next week, Friday, and both our content advisor and the committee coordinator won't be available on that day. So we have to try and get the date during the week. But by Monday, you will get correspondence as to which day are we going to meet to make sure, and which we need to have quorum so that we deal with the external auditor transformation plan and we approve the strategic plan as the auditor has presented. Thank you very much for your... Oh, okay. AG?
Chair, thanks for your indulgence. It's just one thing that I just wanted to plant in the minds of the members. We were on our way here a few weeks ago on a planned engagement for the regulations that will accompany the public audit and amendments. And we respected the feedback that the committee gave us to say that let's wait a bit. I hope that we can get some direction and some date as to how long is the wait going to be, because we are a bit reluctant now that we've progressed our preparations and we've actually finalized these regulations and the input that we need to give to the committee. So if at an earlier stage you could perhaps alert us as to when possibly we can have that engagement. And our sense was that it may not necessarily be an engagement that leads to very concrete decisions, but at least hopefully by the time the bill surfaces, we would have covered some of the ground with you about the regulations, so that at least we can catch you before you are out there, you know, next year, and you have folded the Fifth Parliament and all that, because we wanted to make sure that we finish the journey that we started together before we encounter another committee in the second half of next year, because it might mean that everything that we've done together in this period of time, which has really been a commendable effort, might just go back to zero, and we have to start again with people who may want to be briefed from scratch about those matters. And I think your gains that you have made as a committee in the Fifth Parliament might as well also not get that level of recognition. So I thought, let me just plant that without putting any pressure, but we would appreciate some guidance as to when that engagement could possibly happen. Because on our side, we are ready. Everything that we have prepared around these regulations is in our in-trays, all of us sitting here. We're just waiting to be called and to come and engage you so that we can put it into the out-tray.
Okay. Okay, thanks, AG. We spoke to the House Chairperson, the Chairperson, about the situation. And he has said that we should wait for the President to sign first, but it will be part of the discussion when we meet either Tuesday or Wednesday next week. And we'll write to you on time and make sure that you are available on that day to come and discuss the regulation. But thanks for bringing that up. Thank you very much, honorable members. Have a happy weekend, and for those who are traveling, travel safe. We still need you here. Thank you very much, and you are welcome. I hope you'll come again when we have a meeting. You are the new member of AG's committee. Go ahead. Thank you very much, AG. All the best. Thank you. Thank you.